Amazon Five Star Theater presents Real Customer Reviews, performed by Ed Helms. Tonight's review, Tactical Jacket. I was living a simple life. Didn't get out much. Then, I bought this jacket, and everything changed. Women came flocking to me from lands domestic and foreign. On the 245-day sailboat voyage home, I was attacked by a shark. I knew it was the jacket he was after. Giving up the jacket in exchange for my life. 5 stars. Amazon customer 69. Shop the perfect gift this holiday on Amazon.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Russia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, much in the news, along with the European Union, along with whatever happened to the Soviet Union. All of those extremely powerful stories connect with one particular year in the late 20th century. I learned this from George Friedman, the chairman of Geopolitical Futures, who is here to take us to the false dawn of 1991. George, a very good evening to you. Immediately I smiled when I read your article because, of course, it connected my memory with the wonderful Cold War movie Red Dawn, about how Cuban and Russian paratroopers landed in Colorado and the war that tore apart the United States. But you're writing of another dawn, a false dawn, in 1991. Now, let me cast my memory immediately when I read your piece. That's the year the Soviet Union failed. What else happened in 1991 that we now learn wasn't an end, but just a transition? Good evening to you, George.
Good evening. It's good to be here. Well, aside from the fall of the Soviet Union, the Maastricht Treaty was signed, was agreed to, and that began the European Union, which hadn't been there before. Operation Desert Storm took place, defeating the Iraqis and opening up the door to 9/11. The Japanese economic miracle that would never end ended with a massive financial crash that took a decade to clear up. China, right after Tiananmen Square, began a new policy that had to replace Japan as the massive Asian exporting power. And, you know, when you take a look at all the things that happened here, we can see the world, new world order being announced by the president, President Bush. Because when you looked at all this, it seemed like we had entered an entirely new period. European wars are over. The Soviet Union was gone. Desert Storm, this wonderful alliance of 40 countries making the world right. And Bush really believed this was the new world order, a world harmonious, dealing with rogue states. And as we know, this, things got more complicated and more complicated and more complicated until here we are wondering what's going on in Kazakhstan.
Yes, and I want to go to the New World Order, 1991. That was a very famous departure for George H.W. Bush, who'd come into office after having been vice president with Ronald Reagan and was presented with the Soviet Union fall. But before that, the serial falling of Eastern European sovereignties that had been under the Soviet boot. And I remember, George, I think faintly that there was talk about how Bush did none of this, but he inherited a good hand. And the emphasis on the Berlin Wall being torn down and pieces of it being distributed around the world. So we come back to this metaphor you use of false dawn. We know now what we didn't know then. Were we misled by our leaders? Were they in the dark? Was everybody guessing that the world would be a brighter place, that peace would break out, that we'd beat our swords into plowshares? Were they wrong, George?
They're wrong, but as wrong as we were. They had no greater insight into the world. They saw the Soviet Union, with which we had obsessed, near nuclear war, go away. They saw Europe, in which we had fought bloody war, unite and get rid of them. They saw in Desert Storm the world come together to deal with Saddam Hussein. They saw these things. And because Bush was bright enough to say, I haven't seen this before, I've never seen all of these things happening, he said there was a new world order. And I wasn't misled. He himself and all of us, certainly me, I was misled by myself of saying the world has changed. And now we find out not quite as much as we thought.
Let's go to Desert Storm, because that was a strange feeling that summer, as I recall. I was in Maine with my family, and the deployment of American troops involved commercial airlines being drafted by the U.S. military, gathering up all of these soldiers in luxury seats, what had been luxury seats, and sending them to the Middle East via the airport in Bangor, which was built as a Cold War airport. It's a very long runway. They've always featured it. That's where the bombers would land if they got into trouble. Well, they came through Bangor. There are many photographs up there. And it was a strange summer for me because I saw this sense of we're at war, but then again, we're not, because it's vacation time. And they're landing in the midst of all the other vacationers coming to down East Maine. When George Bush committed the U.S. into defending Kuwait or punishing Iraq, did they speak in Washington of this being the beginning of a struggle in the Middle East that was going to end badly? Did they see ahead, or did they ask those questions, George?
No, they didn't. What they saw was this 40-nation coalition that was willing to go up there and fight. We weren't alone. We were the biggest. We were the most important. But we were accompanied by all of these states. And they looked at this and said, okay, this is the way the world is going to be now. If a country like Iraq invades a small country like Kuwait, we will all come to its assistance. We all have the same interests. We don't have any disagreements. And this was the sense that really tied them together. They looked at this war and couldn't imagine that after this war, it would all come apart with Islamic terrorism and so on. So, no, I think they looked at that moment and they really didn't understand, as many of us didn't.
The Cold War was over momentarily with the fall of Gorbachev's government, the rise of Yeltsin's government. Christmas time, 1991, the end of the year. Was there attention to who Yeltsin was? Was there attention to how the Soviet Union would have to transform itself into, well, the expectation at the time, market economy? Or was it just left to happen, you know, the fatalism, things are going well, don't interfere?
Well, there was a great deal of American presence and advice giving. Diplomats love to give advice. But this is Russia, a very old country, a very large country. And the transition away from something that had been in place since 1917, I mean, this transition was going to be hard and difficult. And we wanted them to be like the United States. And they really aren't like the United States. They're different. And so there was an expectation that we were going to tutor Yeltsin, as we had tutored Gorbachev, because really Reagan had a relationship with him that was almost tutorial. And we thought we were going to tutor Yeltsin. And Yeltsin went different ways and had different understandings. And we didn't see the massive divergence happening. We convinced ourselves that this now was Russia, and Russia was our friend, and all would be well.
The breakup of the Soviet Union was violent. The way it was told to me, this is an anecdote out of Baku, Azerbaijan, which was the oil depot of much of the early parts of the Soviet Union. And one night, the phones just stopped being picked up in Moscow, and our currency was no good, and we didn't know where we were going, and we started from scratch. Now, they've been successful these last 30 years. Perhaps the anecdote is an exaggeration, but I can imagine that was the same effect all along the borderlands, Central Asia, and in Ukraine. That transition overnight to the Soviet Union no longer exists. What do we have, a flag? Do we have a way forward? The United States and others, but chiefly the United States, entered into dialogue with all those former Soviet borderland states, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. All of those states were entered into. Did we plan ahead for their independence? Did we see them as needing our attention, or were they just as we left the Russia drift for itself? Did we let them drift?
Well, as we didn't let them. We didn't have the resources, the capability. We're one country. We can't shape the world. We thought we could. We talked about it. I'll give you an example of Azerbaijan, how we didn't get it. The head of Azerbaijan when it was independent was a guy called Heydar Aliyev. He had also been the head of the KGB in the Soviet Union, and he had been a member of the Politburo. A year before, he realized the Soviet Union was collapsing, and he left the KGB, and he went home to his to Baku, and he started to create a new state. In other words, these people were not stupid. They knew it was going to come apart. They understood way before the Americans did, and they started shaping the future themselves. And they really didn't need the Americans to tell them the way to go. And the Americans really didn't understand, in the case of Azerbaijan that you cited, what exactly was happening.
The puzzle continues. The European Union, the Maastricht Treaty was 1991. The euro was 1999, but we'll stay with the Maastricht Treaty. Today, I note that in these tense negotiations between Washington and Moscow, the European Union is not present at the table, though it is the European Union that is the battlefield between these two states. Is the European Union a disappointment given what it was with the hopes of 1991?
Well, it was built on a fantasy of a European identity, an idea that really all Europeans wanted the same things. Well, the Polish view of the Germans is kind of different. The feelings of the Portuguese are not the feelings of the Greeks. This is a continent, the smallest continent in the world, with about 40 independent states. And they have fought centuries of wars against each other. Now you take some of them, put them together in this organization, and say, you really have the same interests and the same needs. And they all say, yes, sure. And then you ask the question of the immigrants. As the immigration comes in, Hungary says, not a chance. Germany says, we must. And on every issue, they split apart because they're not one country. They're countries with very bad history to each other.
The Chinese. In 1991, China was remaking itself, reorganizing itself after the Tiananmen massacre, after the darkness visible of the tanks rolling over students. In 1991, China, we know now, was bursting with energy to join the capitalist model. Did we understand China at the time? Did we see it as a piggy bank, as an opportunity for sales? Did we understand it stood at risk to slip back into the Maoist thinking?
Well, we still don't understand it. Didn't understand it then. We don't understand. China is China, and it pursues its own interests. And right now, it's an enormous crisis. There's a cycle that goes through. The United States was the first China. It was the first country that's dominated the world markets around 1900, selling cheap goods. The next one was Japan. We may remember Made in Japan as a bad joke we used to have. Now China has run its 40 years, like America, like Japan. It is at the border. It cannot continue dumping products into the world, and it'd like to. So when we spoke of capitalism, we did. We thought China would be like we were back in the 1890s. And we thought that they would be having our values. Well, they have very old values, very different values, and we were disappointed to find out they really were Chinese, but playing the capitalist game.
And we turn now to the present headlines. 1991, it was a false dawn. All of these promises have worked out strangely. Chiefly, we come to the confrontation over Ukraine, invaded by elements of the Russian authorities in 2014, now surrounded, we're told, by Russian troops, and a conversation first at Geneva, now at Brussels, between the once upon a time Western powers led by the United States and the Russian Federation. When we come back with the chairman of Geopolitical Futures, George Friedman. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Find out and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.